Welcome to the Prescription for Admission podcast, where we talk about hospitals and hospital-based care, who you can expect to meet, and what you may experience during your time in the hospital, both as a patient and also as a healthcare provider working in a hospital. My name is Dr. Monique Nugent. I am a practicing hospitalist and also the author of Prescription for Admission, the book, where I talk about many of the same topics. Thank you for joining me and enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome back to the Prescription for Admission podcast. I am your host, Dr. Monique Nugent, and I am here today with a really special guest, Dr. Elisa Khan from Boston Children's Hospital. She is our first pediatric hospitalist, and I hope our first of many pediatric hospitalists who will join us, as I want to spend some time talking about how parents and children navigate hospitals, right? And that experience is kind of very different from the experience that I work in as an adult specialist, right? So, Dr. Khan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Nugent.
Wonderful. So, Elisa, you are at Boston Children's. You are a pediatric hospitalist, correct?
That is correct.
How does one become a pediatric hospitalist? What is the career path to that?
So, it would have been a different answer if you asked me 5 years ago, because it is a newly board specialty. So now the way you become a pediatric hospitalist is you go to medical school, you do a pediatric residency, and then you apply for a pediatric hospital medicine fellowship, which is officially ACGME accredited as of a few years ago, which is like the fancy accreditation body for residencies and all things doctor related. So now it's officially a specialty. So you do that fellowship in pediatric hospital medicine for 2 or 3 years. And you take the pediatric hospital medicine boards, which is an exam that lasts a few hours. And that is how you become a pediatric hospitalist. And like I said, we're a new specialty. So it used to be that you became a pediatric hospitalist by working in a pediatric hospital and taking care of hospitalized children. But now we are an official subspecialty. So there's like official fellowship and board certification and stuff, which is pretty cool.
How long is fellowship?
It varies. It is either some programs are 2 years and some are 3 years. I think it depends on like how much extra like research or academic time you might want, or if you want to get advanced degrees. Sometimes it might be 3 years, but they're generally either 2 or 3 year programs.
2 or 3 year programs. So where would parents and kids run into you? Where are you located practice wise?
Yeah, not a silly question at all. So essentially pediatric hospitalists, or do you mean like pediatric hospitals in general?
Yeah, pediatric
or like me in particular?
In general.
Yeah, that's what I figured. So the place you would run into a pediatric hospitalist is generally a pediatric hospital and on the inpatient wards. And what I mean by the inpatient wards is like if your child is admitted to the hospital, meaning they need to stay overnight or more than one night to the hospital. And the thing that you're being admitted for is kind of a general non-subspecialty issue, then you might get admitted to a pediatric hospital medicine team. And examples of some of those diagnoses might be, say, your child is admitted with pneumonia or urinary tract infection or bronchiolitis or really bad asthma attack that leads you into the hospital and you need to stay for a day or a couple of days. So we're kind of generalists and subspecialists, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The other kind of patient that might encounter a pediatric hospitalist is someone that's coming in with kind of like a diagnosis where we're not sure that it's necessarily cardiology. It's not heart related for sure. It's not pulmonary related for sure. We're trying to figure it out. And so we are kind of like the quarterback. Hopefully that's an accurate sports analogy, but like, so I don't know that much about football.
I'm not the one to correct you though about sports.
So who knows? Maybe, well, yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's the wrong term, but we will coordinate care with different subspecialists. So if you come in with like a fever of unknown origin and we don't know, your child's been having a fever for 3 weeks and we don't know why. We don't know, is it an infection? Is it a rheumatologic disease? God forbid, could it be like an oncologic cancer type thing? So what we'll do is you'd be admitted to the pediatric hospital medicine service. We'll do labs, we'll do a history, and we'll think, are we seeing things that make us think we need to talk to the infection infectious disease specialists, or like the rheumatologists, or the cardiologists, if we think it's a heart condition, or the oncologist. So we will do, so basically it's kind of two buckets of conditions. One are kind of common general inpatient pediatric hospital related things like infections or breathing issues. The second is kind of triaging and quarterbacking between different subspecialists to manage your care. So if you're kind of like a multi-subspecialty requiring patient, or if you, those are the kinds of patients that we see, and that's who you would encounter us. So we're always in the hospital only. You're not going to see us in the pediatrician's office or in the clinic, or generally not in the emergency room, though that might vary. And pediatric hospitals can also work in non-children's hospitals on kind of pediatric units for kind of the, some of the same things I described.
So I remember when I was a kid, I got really sick, and what I now know was like a bad food poisoning. My mom called their pediatrician, and the pediatrician met us in the emergency department, right? Yeah. And was with us and did all that stuff. And then eventually I was discharged home. Those days of like your primary pediatrician being able to go back and forth between their office and the hospital, is that commonplace anymore?
Not anymore. And I'm sorry that you had that experience. That sounds like a not fun experience. I'm glad you're recovered. You're recovered.
It was like tainted strawberries. Sometime in the 90s, there was some like tainted strawberries in the Northeast. And yeah, it was like a thing. But anyway.
Did it make the news?
It did. It was a bad enough foodborne illness that it was like on the news and a bunch of kids got sick.
Wow.
And I remember I ate a bunch of strawberry tarts at a piano recital. I remember the pediatrician asking, did you eat anything? And I was like, I ate all those strawberry tarts. And she was like, there it is. That's the thing. This has been going. And it was like on the news. And my mom is a retired ICU nurse. So she was like in the peak of her ICU-ness at the time. And so at the time, I remember feeling like I was very sick. And now as an adult, having children, being an adult hospitalist, like, yes, I was sick, but like on the scale of sick, I wasn't that ill. But I just remember like my mom looking at IVs and the doctor doing, and I was like, am I going to live? I think I was 14. Aww. I was like 14 or 15 years old. But I do remember my mom calling our pediatrician and being like, we're going to the ER. And the pediatrician's like, I'll be there. And so it's the same thing that happens in the adult wards. That's just not, unfortunately, the way medicine can be practiced anymore.
Right.
Caring for patients in the hospital is a specialty within itself. It's very different, very acute. There's different quality measures, there's different safety concerns. And what I say to adult patients is that having a hospice there, I may not be there, but one of my colleagues is there 24/7. Nursing has access to us all the time. Rapid responses overnight, safety things, admissions in the middle of the night. I think there is a big benefit to having somebody who has specialized their care to sick children in a hospital. That's really specific.
So, yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. It's kind of evolved over time as medicine has gotten more specialized and subspecialized. Mm-hmm. And as the level of sickness and the acuity, if you will, of patients coming in is higher and the complexity, it really is really important to kind of have that specialized skill set, which is why it's a bona fide specialty in and of itself. But back in the day, it was nice to have your pediatrician who you've known come in and be there for you in the hospital. But given how busy things are in the outpatient clinic, it's not so feasible anymore. And that person's not going to be there 24/7, like you said, because they got to get back to their clinic and take care of the patients coming in there. So at Boston Children's, we actually used to have a few, when I first started about 12 or 13 years ago, almost 13 years ago, we used to have a few private pediatricians in the community who would attend inpatient. So they would come in kind of with that more old school, if you will, model. And over the years, the number of pediatric clinics, outpatient pediatricians who come in and take care of patients when they're hospitalized has really gone down just for all of these logistical and subspecialty reasons.
It was the same thing at my hospital. We had a number of private practice docs and then things like night coverage, right?
Yeah.
We would end up covering their patients in the middle of the night. We would end up doing the admissions at the middle of the night. And I think there is an understanding that in order to get the amount of work done that they need to do in the clinic, they have to focus. They have to be
there. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. So thank you for not only being our first pediatric hospitalist, but for being a pediatric hospitalist and caring for the babies as they are in the hospital.
You're welcome. I love it.
Yeah. I'm hoping to introduce many more of your colleagues in the different ways that pediatricians are working in hospitals as the podcast goes on.
Thank you.
I invited you here specifically because a lot of your research is around communication and how people can advocate for themselves, what advocating feels like, what advocating looks like. And that's what I do. I talk about how to be an active participant, right? Getting personal, I am a NICU mama. So my first child was born a little early and spent some time in the NICU. I had my second daughter spent some time in your intensive care unit over there at Children's. And as a parent, you would think that like as a physician and as a physician parent, I would be able to understand how to advocate, how to navigate this. And I don't think I did a great job. Like as far as the NICU situation, you're postpartum, you're like a whole patient yourself. And then you're like advocating for a whole patient as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I have like very little coherent memories about being in like a big active participant. What I remember was following directions. Right. Mm. And that's what I tell people not to do. I always like my whole thing is advocate for yourself, know your information, make sure you're driving care forward. And I remember being like, okay, they said to do this. I do this thing. And if I do this thing, the baby will be okay. And then we can go home maybe. And then it was a kind of, and we'll kind of dive into it. I think my husband and I did a little bit better or a lot better with the PICU situation in that that was a space where my head was a little more clear. I am used to really acute settings and we were able to pick up on something really fine. And we'll touch base on that and advocate for ourselves. But I know the system. Like at the time, I was an associate director for a hospital medicine group. One of my girlfriends works in your ICU. I know how to navigate this, and it's just not a world that a lot of people know how to navigate. So let's get into it. I remember you said something really profound that when your child goes to the hospital, your job is not done, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about that. What does that mean? Your child is sick. You have garnered all your resources. You've got them in the emergency department. And they're like, okay, this child is sick enough, needs to come into the hospital. We are going to take good care of your child. And we want to hope that people are going to take great loving care of our child and do really good. But as a parent, should my guardrails come down? Should my guardrails go up higher? Or should I keep them where they are? Like, should I be at this level of like intensity that I was in minutes ago when I was thinking, oh, this kid is really sick, right? Now you come in, you've agreed with me, and you're like, this kid is really sick. This kid needs to be in the hospital. Tell me, how do I feel and how do I like move forward from there?
Such a great question of like the guardrails and advocating for yourself. And before I answer that, I first want to also acknowledge and thank you for sharing the experience that you had both in the NICU with your first child and then later in the PICU, the pediatric intensive care unit with your second child. And just want to acknowledge that it's really traumatic to be in the hospital as a parent and as a child, especially when you don't expect it. And right in the NICU, so the neonatal intensive care unit for really sick, often premature babies, you don't always get a warning that the baby's coming and you're a patient, like you said, and you're postpartum, but also like you may not have known necessarily that it was going to happen that day in that way, right? So there's also that whole piece that I just want to acknowledge and then get back to your actual question because I have so much more to like unpack about those two experiences and maybe we can do that later so I can actually answer your questions. So your question was about the importance of like your job not ending when you get to the hospital and how you advocate for yourself and like the extent to which your guardrails need to be up. So there's this idea in the literature that frames it as patients and families being vigilant partners in safety is what it's called.
Like that.
And I hope I'm citing the correct investigator. I think it's by someone named Schwab. And it's this idea that you are a partner, you're an expert in your child. Mm-hmm. And so you want to be a partner in care. And in being a partner in care, you can help make care safer for your child. And I would argue for other children and all other patients as well. And the idea behind this kind of vigilant partner in care concept is that, like, as a family member, especially as a parent, right, when we're talking about kids, parents have this, they have motivation around their kid having a good outcome and getting healthy. They have the history of what do they know about their child, not just the history of, like, what are their medical conditions, but also, like, what are they like at baseline? Is this a kid who is normally, like, happy and friendly? And so when you walk into the hospital and they're like this, that is not their normal. Or right. are they someone who's, like, a little guarded in the hospital anyway, right? So parents have this historical information, both of their child's medical history, but then also just, like, how does their kid roll? Like what's normal, what's baseline for their kid? So they actually, we talk a lot about patient families being experts in their child, right? Like they know that, hey, when my child is feeling well, this is how they act. When they're sick, this is how they act. Or, like, this isn't right. This is very alarming to me, because the baseline of a child is so important. I also do some time on the complex care service at Boston Children's Hospital, which is another specialized hospitalist service that is for children with medical complexity. So many of them have technology dependence, like they might have a feeding tube or a breathing tube, and often they have multiple medical systems involved, and often they will have some developmental delays. So the way in which they communicate might be different than the way in which other children communicate. And those, that's such a great example of the importance of the family in that patient population in particular, though it's important everywhere, because I have had patients where that could be their baseline, to be lying there with their eyes closed, not interacting. And that's not them on a sick day, that's them on a regular day. And there are other patients who have medical complexity who are sick, who normally, if you're sitting there and they're sitting there, lying there, not interacting with you, that is not their normal. And you don't know, because people exist along a spectrum. Yeah. Children exist along a spectrum, especially children with medical complexity. So it's so important. You don't know till you talk to the family, hey, is this baseline for your child, or is this, like, way out there? And sometimes two children can look the same and the answer is this is baseline. And another time it's way out there. And for one kid, you're like, okay, you're good. And the other kid, you're like, oh God, we got to call the ICU and get you over there.
That's really, really key, because those kids grow up and I see them as adults.
Yeah. Yes.
And I ask their caretakers those same questions. Yes. On a good day, how is he? And they'll say, oh, he can eat. He likes this X, Y, and Z show. He'll say hi. He'll say bye. Or, like, he's just kind of really quiet and likes to listen to his music, and we give him his feeding tube. So that baseline is hugely important.
Huge. Yes.
What do you say to parents, particularly sometimes you hear with new moms, the complaint that, I know my kid, and I went in and I was like, this is not right for my kid. And nobody's hearing me. No one is listening to what I'm saying. Right? Because to me, that's someone who's a vigilant partner. Right? Mm-hmm. What do you say? How best can they advocate and navigate that kind of sticky situation?
Yeah. And when I hear that situation where a parent, whether they're a new parent or an experienced parent, is telling me, I am worried about something, that something isn't right, and I feel like I'm not being heard, that gives me super pause. Like, that's a pause moment of, let me stop and listen to you and figure out, what am I missing, or what are we missing? So I think my advice to patients and families in that situation, when you feel like something's not right, but you're not being heard, my advice is to keep talking and to keep advocating for yourself and to keep speaking up. And if the first person you talk to, you feel like you're not being heard by them, then I would say, talk to the next person, or ask, hey, is there another person around that I could also share this with? Or is there a supervisor? Is there a supervising nurse, a supervising doctor that I could also talk to? And I think that sometimes naming what it is you're scared about can be really helpful because we all have different things that we're scared about, right? Like, and so much of it is unsaid, right? Like, I remember a time when my daughter sprained her ankle and we, like, it wasn't going exactly as expected. So we ended up seeing orthopedics, the bone doctor. And I remember being like, okay, this is probably just like an ankle sprain, but like, okay, inside my head, what I didn't want to say out loud was like, I'm also worried about like, is this some sort of like indolent late, like infection in her bone? Of course, my mind goes to all the like serious things I see as an inpatient pediatrician, as a hospitalist, right? So I'm like, does she have a septic arthritis, which is like infection in her joint? Now, the objective pediatric hospitalist part of me is like, she probably doesn't. But the mom part of me is like, oh my God, what if? Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh, or what if this is cancer? And that's why she's having. And there's part of me that's like, okay, this is probably not these things. But, and so I remember going to the orthopedic doctor. I think I was actually on service. So this was me on speakerphone while my husband took her there. And I remember saying to him, like, you're sure this isn't like, and I felt so silly saying this, but I was like, so you're sure this is like a joint or something? And I felt silly because I was like, is he going to judge me for like asking this question that I should know it's not? But I was like, but it's my kid. I'm just going to put myself out there. And so I needed to kind of name the thing I was worried about in order to be reassured that like, don't worry, we don't think that. But also, I hear you. It's scary. And so I think what my advice to families in that situation is ask other people, but also name what it is you're scared about. Because sometimes we don't, like, as the doctor, we don't know what you're scared about. Like, you may be scared that they're going to miss their dance recital and you just spent, like, a bunch of money for this dance recital and that's what you're worried about. Or you may be worried, like, we have a history of cancer. Is this my child's way of showing cancer? And both of those things might show up different ways. And so if you say to me, I'm really worried and here's what I'm scared about, tell me if I'm totally out there and I'll take it. But like secretly, I know this might be out there, but this is what I'm worried about. And so sometimes it maybe reminds us doctors and nurses in the hospital of like, oh, we get that. Like there have been times when we've been worried about something with a loved one. But then, yeah, sometimes you just have to keep saying it, keep escalating, keep saying it different ways. We actually are just publishing this study or submitting the study, doing the study on something we call listening neglect, which is this idea of not being listened to in the hospital. And we are finding there are different ways that it shows up. Like sometimes it shows up where you're not listened to till you keep escalating and you keep saying it and saying it and saying it. There are other times it shows up where you might feel like you're being dismissed or disregarded. And there are other ways it shows up. But one of the themes we found was this like need to escalate till you're heard. So it just reminded me of that concept when you were mentioning what do you do when patients say. And I think just keep advocating because it's back to that idea of vigilant partners in care. Your doctors, your nurses, your hospitals, they are experts for sure in the medicine, in the system, in all of those things. And you are an expert in your child. And if you think something doesn't seem right, trust your gut. But name it because that's something, maybe something that is that we can easily reassure. I totally hear you're scared about this, but here are the 10 reasons why I don't think it's that. But I totally get as a parent why you'd worry about that. So I think that would be my very long answer to your short question.
Name it and keep saying it. I too have found myself at the Boston Children's Orthopedic Clinic for this because there's like there's that fear. We've all heard the stories of the doctor's kid who walks around with like a broken arm, a broken leg for like ever. And one of my children was limping for a while. And I was like, yeah, you're fine. Yeah, you're fine. And then I was like, am I being that doctor that like, and I did say the thing, but the same thing, I felt embarrassed. And I was just like, it's not like a sarcoma, right? Like, he's like, what? I was like, it's not like a osteosarcoma. Like, he's like, God, no. Like, I was like, okay, I just had to say it. I just had to. It's like, it is not bone cancer. Like, no, but I said it. And you're right. I felt, and maybe it's that professional part of you that feels that you're saying the ridiculous thing, but he at least knows where my mind is. And he was very lovely. He called me.
So was my.
But it ended up being like a nothing thing. It ended up being just like growing pains.
Yeah.
But those are real too. And
those are real.
Yeah, and my kids go, my danger threshold, my husband is also a physician. He's family practice. He sees kids. So he has a different danger threshold.
Right.
And since my danger threshold is lower, that is the danger threshold that we go by. And so like anything that mom is like, oh, is this a thing? Like, and I go to the pediatrician. I say it out loud. Maybe another episode we'll talk about the time where like I was being brushed off and I was
there
with another
time. We all have those stories.
And moms and dads like keep saying it. And name it. And I think this is really, really great advice.
Yeah, keep saying it, keep naming it, and maybe I'll add a third summary, is you're an expert, and you don't need to have a medical degree, you don't need to have any degree, you just need to know your child, which you do, or you wouldn't be there. Mm. And so, like, honor your expertise, and like, and just know that, and that you're important, and your voice matters.
So there are some people who feel, and data shows it, that like when they advocate for themselves, people may see them as being pushier or put them in different categories. There are explicit biases that people carry. There are implicit biases that people carry.
Yes, there are.
I have a friend who is a woman of color, who had a child who's complicated. And she said, I felt like every time I would advocate, they would look at me as like, she is being a bitch, right? This is my podcast. Mm. So if I say we can curse, we can curse. First curse drop on the pediatric podcast, right?
Tracks. But
yeah. Those to deny that these biases exist is wrong. What do you say to those populations that feel like they have, rightfully feel like they have an uphill battle for advocating for themselves and being heard and being treated appropriately, right? And this hits home for us as mothers of color, as hospitalists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can't deny that this is happening in hospitals.
Absolutely.
And healthcare, right?
And the world.
And the world. So, and I'm giving you an impossible answer, like, question. Sorry, I'm giving you an impossible question. Because the answer is like, it's horrible. It's horrible. It shouldn't happen. And this is... has to be acknowledged so that we can continue to root it out of the system. But it is a reality that people are living in. And so how do we live within that reality?
It's such a good question. I think we live within that reality by acknowledging that it's a thing, that it's real, these experiences that so many patients and families of color and of so many different backgrounds that are systematically marginalized by society, by healthcare, that there are times where you are experiencing implicit bias, explicit bias, systemic bias. I do a lot of work on language equity, meaning how to provide care for patients who speak languages other than English. And that's a really great example of systemic bias, right? Where hospitals aren't always set up with all of the interpretation and translation resources, and they aren't always utilized effectively or accessible. And so you're getting a different care experience than in most cases if you speak a language other than English. So yes, the implicit bias is real. The explicit bias is real. The systemic bias is real in healthcare and society. And I think it's knowing that it's real and that it hurts and that it's hard. Right? Like the friend you're giving the example of, like, I wonder if this comes up for her, where it's like this added burden that you carry, right? As a caregiver, where your kid's already sick and you're already taking them to the doctor, taking them to the nurse, going to the hospital and worried about them. And then you also have to be like, oh, is someone going to treat me differently because of who I am and things I can't change about myself? And am I going to have to work that much harder to make sure that I'm not getting pigeonholed into some stereotype? And it's a lot of like mental energy on top of all the other mental energy of being a parent, when your kid is sick, of navigating healthcare, which isn't easy. And so I don't know if I have a good answer other than like, it's real and it sucks and it's hard, and I see you and I hear you and I am there with you. And there's so many of us in the healthcare system that are there trying to recognize and acknowledge that it's real and trying to do what we can to bring awareness to it, to our own biases. We all have them, right? And trying to figure out how can we do better. And when it specifically comes to this topic around speaking up and around advocating, how do we as healthcare systems and healthcare and clinicians, how do we learn, and we talked about this a little the other day, but how do we give people grace and say that even if someone's having a big feeling because their kid is sick, let's give them a little grace and be like, hey, there might be a part of this that's bringing up something that's not even about the matter at hand. It might be around something else that's going on in your life or some other experience that you've had in life, whether it's racism or whether it's you had a stressful day at work or something's triggering you and it's reminding you of childhood experiences that you've had that have been negative. So I think like we in the healthcare system need to just kind of have a little more grace around that. And as we talked about, that doesn't mean that we as healthcare providers take abuse.
Yeah.
And so we are allowed to similarly advocate for ourselves and say, hey, that's not an appropriate way to speak. I want to provide really good care for your child. And right now it's hard for me to focus on that because I'm feeling attacked. So can we take a minute to reset? And can we try to rephrase this because I want to do right by your child. And I know you want the same. We're here for this common goal, which totally went on another tangent, but
I think, especially some of the things that have been in the news lately with a poor nurse was really attacked.
Yes, exactly.
And it's a high pressure system. It's an intense experience for anybody. It's an intense experience to be sick. It's an intense experience for your child to be sick. It's an intense experience to be advocating for people. It's an intense place to work. And I love that idea of how do we learn to, in general, give each other grace and space to have our feelings, understand that everyone's coming to the table. I am not a blank sheet when I show up to tend to your loved one, right? I'm bringing with you my something here. I'm not going to tell you many 40 years, but like my years of life, my experiences, the different hospitals I've worked in, how people have treated me in the past, while also putting together clinical situations. And then also you as a parent, like you said, you're not a blank sheet either. You're coming in with all of those experiences of like feeling dismissed in the past. How did I advocate? What worked? What didn't work? Oh, I remember how someone like this treated me in the past when my child had this concern. And so it is. It's like it's just a high pressure system. And I love that. Give each other as much grace as we can.
Yeah, which is hard when the stakes are so high. It's hard for the providers and it's hard for the families. And so I get that sometimes we miss each other.
Something that I advocate for, I tell people to formalize their concerns. That like there are systems that hospitals have to track poor outcomes, adverse effects, adverse outcomes, near misses, true events, and then also people's behavior within the system. And what I do tell people is like try and formalize if you your experience, because then that goes into a system. And it may not feel like someone is looking at it, but somewhere down the line, a Dr. Khan is looking at it, right? And not only doing her research on it, but giving feedback to people. And we never know if somebody is like problematic unless patterns are picked up. And patterns can't be picked up if there's no like formal paper trail, right? And so you may feel like this respiratory therapist is always rude to us every time we come here. And this respiratory therapist is great, right? Formalize both of those because people need to hear good feedback. And then also formalize your concerns that this respiratory therapist has been very nasty to us each and every time. You never know like how many other families have that experience and never formalize it or have that experience and formalize it. And then in the system, somebody, when they do an eval goes, whoa, wait a minute. You've had a bunch of families say that this is a behavior pattern. So there are ways to formalize your concern about your experience. And
absolutely.
Somewhere down the line, it's going to feel like no one's listening. It's going to feel like it goes into a void. But the best is hope is that someone is doing the work somewhere down the line and they will see it. And so that is one way that I tell people they can kind of feed into that system that you were saying,
yeah,
improve safety, improve experience, improve outcomes for not only their child, but for others.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think I love what you said about formalizing the positive experiences you have, because that positive feedback is helpful too. Because then it's like, okay, we should keep doing that. And the kind of constructive feedback is really helpful too, because then it's like, hey, what is the underlying? And I often like, yes, sure, they're like bad apples in the world, sure. And then there's also systems that set up recurring patterns. Mm-hmm. And what is it? And so maybe what is it about that particular respiratory therapist? Is there something going on in their workspace or in their personal life that is leading them to act in that way? And are there ways we could support that person? So I love that idea of kind of formalizing things. And I would add that it's, like you said, to make things better for your family and your child, and actually to make it better for all others as well. And I've done a lot of research on this concept of families safety reporting. What that means is patients and families, ways for hospitals to put into place systems for patients and families to share concerns, comments, compliments, suggestions about the safety and quality of their care. And what we found is that families are really good at it, and they identify a lot of like medical errors, so kind of like medical mistakes, harms due to medical care, and they're just as good at it as doctors and nurses are. Like, I literally have done studies that show that. So getting back to our parents are experts, parents are vigilant partners in safety. But what's really interesting is what we found in a lot of interviews we did with families and doctors and nurses and hospital leaders was the thing that resonated with everyone around formalizing concerns, comments, suggestions about safety was what really resonated with people was like, I'm doing this for this patient and all other patients, because really that idea of like, how can we make it better, not just for this situation, but all other situations. And so I think when we frame our improvement in the hospital as doctors and nurses and healthcare providers, and as patients and families, when we frame it around like, how do we make it better for everyone? It takes a little bit of the pressure off, like, oh, it's not just about me. It's not just about this one nurse or this one doctor. It's about all of it.
All of us.
And the more we can work together in this complementary, messy system, we're all equal partners, the more we can figure out where are the things that are working well, let's keep doing those and make them better. And where are the things where things aren't working and how can we address those? And how can we do it in a way that like the focus isn't on like blaming any one person? Because the other really interesting thing that we found was in thousands of patient interviews and surveys we've done, it is like, I actually can't even think of a single one where they were naming a person. It wasn't about like Dr. So-and-so. Ah. It was about
the system.
How that experience made them feel and the system. Mm. And so like, I totally agree with you. Like you need to name things sometimes by name, and you also need to name things just by what's happening so that we can track them and make them better and how important that is. And just that families are really good at it. And we just need to make systems in place that we invite that input. So it doesn't have to, like what I would love, my dream is that we ask all families and we mean it and we take that feedback. Yeah. And we do it with grace and we say transparently, like, look, you're an expert. We're an expert. Let's work together, make it better for everyone. And we can't promise we'll fix it like this, but we're going to try.
Yeah. Awesome. So, I think
another tangent.
That's not a tangent. It's true. I don't know the quote. I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, but I saw something a long time ago that said, and it really spoke to me, that like my job as a mother is not just to smother my children with my love, but to extend my love and my mothering to all the children.
Yes.
Oh. And I think about that when I think about advocating for my kids. I often think,
yes,
like, who is going to come behind them that's going to have a better experience because of it? Who's going to come behind them? Or who will be in their class and also benefit from the thing that I'm doing? And I love that idea of, we are in this together. The children that go to a hospital could be any one of our children at any point in time. And how do we improve the system for all of our children? And I think that's really a beautiful, beautiful way of thinking about, because it's scary. I'm sorry, thinking about how to navigate giving feedback, because it's scary. People feel like they will get retribution. That's something that I hear often. They'll be labeled. They'll, like, if I say this, then they're going to give me my med. They might hurt my kid. They might. So that's a scary thought process that they're putting themselves out there as well. And that idea, I love what you said. We're doing this because we're in this boat. We're all here together caring for these children. So thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And that quote is beautiful. And I think our society needs a little more of that. Like, I'm here as a parent to everyone. It's not just about my child. I love that.
Whoever said that, you have credit. I don't remember who said it.
It's beautiful.
But it's like changed my life.
I love that.
In the couple minutes we have to wrap up, something I like to ask people to end our conversation is there like a TV show, a movie, something that is portraying your work that you think out there is doing a great job, or something that's doing like a horrible job? And hospital medicine in general is a fairly young field.
Yeah. Right?
So outside of Scrubs, they were hospitalists in Scrubs. They were hospitalists, right? Outside of Scrubs, like, most hospital shows are like in the ER, right? Because that's the exciting place to be. Or they're following surgeons around, right? And so when I first said, Alyssa, I'm going to ask you this question. And you were like, oh. And then I was like, oh, my goodness. Like, she's right. So I've come up with my answer. Let's see.
I forgot this homework, so I'm going to have to wing it. I don't know if there is, like, if I've seen, like, pediatric hospitalists. And I'm a TV buff, so this is maybe, like, embarrassing myself in my TV skills. But I'm not, like, a big medical show watcher, to be fair.
Oh, really?
No. My preferred genre is teenage dramedies from around the world. I'm, like, vicariously living. Okay. I don't know. That's my. So, like, I don't know if you've seen School Spirits or, like, Heartbreak High or, like, Dairy Girls.
Oh, I love Dairy Girls. That one cracked me up.
Yeah. You got to make it halfway through the first episode and finish the first episode, and then you're like, oh, my God.
Oh, so, yeah. It's great.
The show I'm watching right now that I have had some moments where, like, the experience of parents in the healthcare system has come up and I've had some, like, feelings, is I'm watching Working Moms, which is a Canadian comedy. I'm like almost done with season seven, but there've been it's really funny and, like, relatable. And as a working mom, but there've been a couple of episodes where they have interacted with the healthcare system. And there's, like, one or two episodes where the main character is, like, a marketing executive. Or PR, I don't know.
Yeah, I started watching the show since you told me.
Keep watching. Oh, and? Are you more into it? Not yet?
No, I find them very annoying. So, like, literally yesterday I was like, I'm going to see Alyssa tomorrow. Let me turn this on. And I was just like, I can't watch this. So.
Okay, to each their own. I love that you did your homework and I didn't, but it's cool. There are times where she is bringing her child to the hospital. I think one time they have, like, measles or something. And that was, like, prescient, because I don't know that measles were quite a big thing yet. But they have, and again, this takes place in Canada, so we have a whole different healthcare system, and it's statewide healthcare. But there have been times where I've been like, wait, is this an over-the-top experience of families being dismissed in the hospital? Mm. Or, like, is there something to this? And it's funny because my first gut reaction is like, oh, this is over the top. This must just be how it rolls in Canada. And then I'm like, Canada's pretty awesome, so probably not. But I think there's some truth to it, because some of the scenes, the main character is expressing, like, feelings of being dismissed, like we talked about, or feelings of, like, fear and guilt, like, am I there? Did I do the right thing? Mm. And sometimes, like, it's a little exaggerated the way I feel like there's, like, a scene of rounds where they're just kind of, like, ignoring her and talking around her and, like, saying some judgmental stuff. And I was like, this feels a little exaggerated, and then maybe not.
Maybe that's how the writers, right? Because you and I are in it. That's how people experience it. Because I do think, like, in medicine, we'll walk in and people will say, like, we're going to talk shop for a little bit. And
my pet peeve. Yes.
Yeah. But I think that's, like, an attempt to say, I acknowledge that you're there and that what we're going to do right now is kind of weird and obtrusive, and we're just going to talk amongst ourselves about you while you sit there, and then we're going to pull up the sheets and we're going to look at you and your wound, and then we're going to use more words about it. And then I will acknowledge you as a patient, right? So I do think that, like, yeah, that maybe that's how the writers experience being parents within healthcare, which a lot of people can say that, I feel like I don't get heard.
Yeah, so my answer
is not as insightful. Oh. I was just going with George Clooney from ER in the 90s, like the OG pediatric professional in a hospital. He was, I couldn't tell if he was a pediatric hospice, which it probably wasn't because of how just the age range of the, or the year where the show took place. I think he was a pediatric emergency medicine physician.
Ah, right. ER.
Yeah, but I think he was like the OG presentation of a pediatrician on TV, at least to like people like me and you. Like, he was the first one that I could remember specifically pediatrician. And so there are a couple of very dramatic episodes where there was one baby who was born in the ED, which like rarely happens. Mm-hmm. Emergency departments have whole sections for pregnant people. Baby's born in the ED and the baby's not responding. And here comes George Clooney, and he does some resuscitative stuff. And then the baby cries and everyone's like, yay. And then I think they like try to name the baby after him. They're like, you son of a baby. George Clooney. So George Clooney in the 90s, who was no less handsome in the 90s as he is today. He is the first physician on television I can remember being a pediatrician. And then they replaced him with a guy named Luca. I don't know the actor's name.
I remember Luca.
Who was also a pediatrician. And he was like a brooding pediatrician as opposed to George Clooney's character, who was like really happy. And then there's a show called Private Practice. Do you remember? It was an offshoot.
I do remember Grey's Anatomy. Right.
Addison, with obstetrician at the redhead, And they had another brooding pediatrician, which I was like, I don't know where, like, he had substance use issues, and not to say that cannot happen.
Absolutely,
across the board. But I remember being like, that's an interesting choice. Because usually that's not what you would think. Because it's just not how people would think of portraying a pediatrician. Do you remember the pediatrician in Scrubs?
It's so funny that you're pointing to all these pediatricians in shows that I have watched, and I have no recollection of them being pediatricians. And you know why it is? My dad is a pediatrician, and growing up, he was a pediatric hospitalist before it was like a real thing. But he was that, and all my life, I was like, I want to be a doctor because it's so fun. But I don't think I realized that they're different specialties. So to me, what he did was what it meant to be a doctor. It wasn't until I was in med school and I was like, oh, I have to pick one of these. And it's totally different if you're a dermatologist than if you're a pediatrician than if you're a surgeon. Like, I didn't understand that. So maybe that's why, because maybe every doctor show, I'm just like, all doctors are the same. I didn't realize pediatricians are any different. So I feel like I need to go back and watch some shows with pediatricians. And
well, the pediatrician in Scrubs is like a one episode thing.
Okay.
Where Dr. Cox brings his child to the pediatrician. And I love that interaction because the pediatrician is like this gruff type of doctor, which again, like, you wouldn't think of a pediatrician. Yeah. But he spoke to him about what you and I experienced. And he said to him, you've seen the worst. Your mind is always going to go to the worst about your child. My job is to like be realistic about it. And I remember like,
that's really beautiful.
That's like where I am as
the best pediatrician on TV.
I am as a physician parent. He's right. Like, my mind often goes to the worst, right?
Yeah.
And it's not just as a physician parent. I have parents of my own who are getting a little older. And like, anytime they're like, oh, this hurts, my mind can go to the worst.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I don't think it's meant to be as beautiful as an interaction as it was for me. Or maybe like when I first watched it and I was a single woman with no kids, I didn't like put it together. But now it just means something different to me.
Sounds so pretty profound now.
Those were the pediatricians I could think of in hospitals on TV.
I love that. I gotta go watch some more TV is the main message to me.
I feel like I used up all of my answers. So when I have more pediatricians, I'm just going to use the same answers. Well, this has been a pleasure, Dr. Elisa Khan. And I hope you come back and join us for more episodes. But this has been really great. Great tips, great insights, really realistic stuff for parents. Keep saying what you're saying. Say it often, escalate it, and name it. And maybe we in healthcare can learn to give each other and our parents, our patients' parents, some space and grace in the high-pressure system that is healthcare. So thank you again. And everybody, thank you for joining us on the Prescription for Admission podcast, where we talk about all things hospitals. And today was our first foray into all things pediatric hospitals.
Woohoo!
Yeah. So thank you. And everyone, have a good day.
Thanks so much, Dr. Nugent. Bye.